Welcome to the Divergent Files podcast. Before we had books, before we had Google, before we even had an alphabet, we had stone. And one night, a man tried to save something with it. It's nighttime. The air is thick, smells like copper and smoke. Ash falls from the sky like snow, but this snow burns when it touches your skin. Down in a stone hallway, beneath the city of Nineveh, a man in robes is sweating through his prayers. He's not just scared, he's terrified. Outside, the city is dying. Flames chew through temples. Statues collapse. The king is gone. The gates are gone. And the gods, they're quiet. The man kneels over a stone tablet. It's not myth, it's not poetry. It's a record of something too dangerous to say out loud. His hands are shaking, but he seals it under the floor, behind bricks, behind mortar. He hopes the fire doesn't find it. He hopes the next people who find it will understand. But that's not what happens. The fire didn't destroy the tablet. Time didn't erase it. We found it, and then we ignored it. The tablets survived the fire, but not the translation. You ever dig a hole and accidentally uncover something ancient, like a weird bone or maybe a toy from the 90s? Now imagine digging up 30,000 stone tablets from a ruined palace in Iraq and realizing they hold the oldest receipts on Earth. That's what happened in 1849 when a British explorer named Austin Henry Layard was poking around some ancient ruins near Mosul. He wasn't an archaeologist. He was basically Indiana Jones with a better mustache. And what he found wasn't treasure. It was a library. A library that shouldn't have existed. Because inside these tablets, written in cuneiform, the world's oldest written language, was stuff that absolutely should not have been known 2,700 years ago. So let's go down the list. First up, a flood story older than Noah's Ark by over 1,000 years. And it's almost identical. Man warned by gods, a big boat, animals, global wipeout. Except this version was written by a people who weren't supposed to have heard of the Bible, because the Bible didn't exist yet. Then we have a map of the night sky, not for stargazing, but for tracking an asteroid. And this wasn't vague, oh no, a comet nonsense. It was detailed. It had coordinates. It matched an actual strike zone in Austria that NASA would confirm thousands of years later. There was even a king, Ashurbanipal, who claimed he could speak with gods in his sleep. He didn't need a priest, didn't need a sacrifice. He just laid down, closed his eyes, and said the heavens talked back. And here's the wildest part. Math. Space math. Some of these tablets showed knowledge of planetary orbits and motion that we didn't rediscover until the Renaissance. Like Galileo level stuff, 2,000 years early. From people who, according to most historians, were supposed to think the Earth was flat and carried on the back of a turtle or whatever they think. So, what did we do with this? Did we flip out? Rush to translate every single tablet? Not quite. We found it, we stored it, and then we just kind of stopped. Stopped translating, stopped digging, stopped talking about it. The most advanced knowledge from the ancient world, and we shelved it like a dusty high school yearbook. The oldest library in the world wasn't lost. It was buried again on purpose. So let's rewind the tape. long before the internet, before the pyramids had tour buses, before even Rome was a gleam in anyone's eye, there was Nineveh. Now, where was it? It's in modern-day Iraq. Back then, it was the beating heart of the Assyrian Empire, one of the most powerful civilizations on Earth, and also one of the most terrifying. These guys didn't mess around. They conquered, they enslaved, and erased entire cities without blinking. Imagine the IRS with swords. That was Nineveh. When are we talking? About the 7th century BC, so roughly 2,700 years ago. Now, while most of Europe was still painting on cave walls, these people were already running libraries, tracking stars, and possibly talking to gods. Pretty fun combo. Now, meet their final boss, King Ashurbanipal. This dude was different. Yeah, he was a warlord. Yeah, he had people flayed alive for looking at him funny. But he also, brace yourself, knew how to read. Now, that might not sound impressive today, but back then, it was like being a wizard. Ashurbanipal could read Sumerian, Akkadian, and even some languages that were already considered ancient in his own time. He didn't just collect stories from his empire, he hunted down old knowledge like it was treasure. And when he found it, he didn't just toss it in a box. He cataloged it, he archived it, he built an entire underground vault to protect it. He didn't write most of it, he stole it. Straight up looted Babylon's sacred texts, carted them off to Nineveh, and organized them into what we now call the Library of Ashurbanipal. But let's be real, it wasn't a library, it was a black site for knowledge. This guy wasn't running story time. He was stockpiling the ancient world's cheat codes. And he didn't just stash them randomly either. Some tablets were sealed in clay boxes, wrapped in protective shells. Others were buried under temple floors as if to hide them from something or someone. This wasn't casual collecting. This was a panic room for truth. Now fast forward to 1849. Enter British explorer Sir Austin Henry Layard and his assistant Hormuzd Rassam. They're digging around the ruins of Nineveh, not expecting much. And then, boom, they stumble on a chamber filled with broken walls and thousands of rectangular clay slabs. Not rocks, books. Except these books were baked solid and covered in wedge-shaped symbols called cuneiform, basically the emojis of the ancient world. They pull out over 30,000 tablets, most of them packed with language, astronomy, medicine, myth, laws, rituals, every topic you could think of. And just like that, Ashurbanipal's secret stash gets exposed. Ashurbanipal didn't collect this stuff to make a museum. He didn't even use it to educate his people. He hoarded it, like a doomsday prepper for knowledge. So here's the question. Was he building a sacred vault to preserve human wisdom? Or a classified archive of something he was afraid might be destroyed or worse, used? He didn't just save knowledge, he stockpiled it, like he knew something was coming. So what exactly did Ashurbanipal squirrel away in this ancient fireproof panic room? Well, turns out, a lot more than bedtime stories about gods and monsters. This wasn't some ancient BuzzFeed list of 10 fun myths to share with your goat herd. This was a hardcore archive, full of receipts. Real ones. Written in clay. Baked in fire. And preserved for almost 3,000 years like they knew we'd eventually forget everything and need a reboot. So let's crack open a few of the greatest hits from Ashurbanipal's stash. First up, the Epic of Gilgamesh. This one's a banger. It's older than the Bible, and it includes a full-on flood story that sounds almost exactly like the one from Genesis. We're talking angry gods, a man warned in advance, a massive boat, animals two by two, and the world getting wiped clean. But, except this version, predates the Noah story by over 1,000 years. Also, the main guy, Gilgamesh, is part human, part god, and goes on a mission to find immortality after his best friend dies. It's grief, divine politics, ancient DNA, and bad road trips all in one. And unlike a lot of ancient stuff, it's shockingly readable, almost like whoever wrote it was trying to be understood by someone way in the future. The Enuma Elish. Think of this one as the Mesopotamian version of Star Wars. A cosmic battle, a rebellion in the heavens, a god named Marduk slices a chaos dragon named Tiamat in half and turns her body into the sky and the earth. It's violent, it's weird, and honestly, it sounds a lot like symbolic planetary formation if you squint hard enough. And here's the twist. Some researchers believe this isn't a fairy tale. It's a myth-coded record of something that actually happened. Maybe a cosmic collision, a planetary war, or something we now file under deep time trauma. Next up, medical manuals. Yeah, ancient surgery. They had clay tablets detailing how to treat wounds, what kinds of bleeding meant you were screwed, which gods to pray to when someone's guts were leaking out. But here's the surprising part. Some of the medical descriptions still make sense today. They weren't just throwing herbs at people and hoping for the best. They were categorizing symptoms, tracking outcomes, and get this, doing autopsies to learn more. Autopsies in the 600s BC. Who was teaching them that? Next up, divination texts. This is where things get real strange. Some tablets were full-on spiritual instruction manuals, reading the future in sheep livers, interpreting dreams, spotting omens in how smoke curls from a fire. One tablet literally describes what it means if a goat gives birth facing east. Spoiler, nothing good. But underneath the goat guts and incense smoke, there's a pattern. These weren't fortune tellers. They were data analysts in priest robes, running the same experiments, logging outcomes, trying to figure out how to predict chaos. And next, the astronomy logs. And now we're cooking. The Assyrians didn't just look up at the stars and go, neat. They were tracking eclipses, planetary alignments, moon cycles, solar flares, and all of this, not just for fun. They tied these events to real-world consequences like plagues, crop failures, and political collapse, which actually feels pretty relevant. Some of the tablets even mention what rituals to perform when Mars and Saturn appear too close together. You know, just in case reality starts acting up. And now here's the real plot twist. This one's cataloged in the British Museum. It's not hidden, but barely anyone talks about it. Why? Well, it's because it contains something no one expected. Planetary orbital math. Not myths, math. It lists planet positions and even includes a weird cuneiform description of speed and distance that aligns suspiciously well with what we now know from heliocentric astronomy. And that's the science that proves the sun is at the center and the planets orbit around it. This wasn't some lucky guess either. It's organized, labeled, logged like someone had been watching for a very, very long time. And here's the kicker. Modern science didn't rediscover this kind of orbital logic until guys like Copernicus and Kepler showed up 2,000 years later. So now the question becomes, how did they know? Who taught them? What were they looking for? And why was Ashurbanipal so obsessed with saying it all? Why was he obsessed with saving it all just in time for his city to burn? All right, so let's get weird. Buried deep in Ashurbanipal's stash was a clay tablet known today as K.8538. Catchy name, right? rolls right off the tongue. Most people just call it the planisphere, basically a circular map of the stars. But this tablet wasn't made to decorate your ancient living room. It was a log, a sky chart. And if one pair of researchers are right, it might be a first-hand eyewitness account of a cosmic disaster. So let me explain. In 2008, two British researchers, Alan Bond and Mark Hemsel, decided to take another look at this tablet using modern star mapping software. And quick note, Bond was a spacecraft systems engineer. Hemsel was an aerospace lecturer at the University of Bristol. These weren't tinfoil hat bloggers, they were engineers. What they did was feed the tablet's star data into a sky simulation program to try and recreate what the sky might have looked like thousands of years ago, specifically over the ancient Near East. And what they found was bananas. The planisphere records the sky on a very specific date, June 29th, 3123 BC. Now let's be real, how many ancient cultures even cared about June 29th? But this one did, because the sky wasn't normal that night. Their translated version of the tablet describes a massive object streaking across the sky, breaking apart as it approached Earth. It wasn't a star, it wasn't a god, it was a comet. And it wasn't just passing by. It was headed straight for the Alps, specifically a region called Kofels in modern-day Austria. Now here's where the whole thing gets chilling. The Kofels region does have strange geology. It has a massive landslide scar, crushed quartz formations, shocked minerals found at deep layers. These are all signs of a high energy impact, the kind you get when a rock from space punches a hole in the planet. But the problem was, for a long time, mainstream scientists didn't think it was caused by an asteroid. They said it looked more like a landslide, like a big one. But this was until they realized maybe it was both. According to Bond and Hemsel, the comet didn't smash straight down. It grazed the atmosphere and hit at a shallow angle, basically skipping across the surface like a rock on a lake. And that would explain why the impact zone is long and weird instead of round, why there's no giant crater, and why it caused a slide big enough to vaporize forests and shake the Alps. So, now here's the gut punch. The Sumerian tablet recorded all of this, 5,000 years before we figured it out with the satellites. And wait, what did NASA say? Nothing. NASA has never publicly commented on the planisphere tablet or the Kofels alignment, not once. Which is pretty weird considering the satellite mapping of the area matches the described impact path. The math checks out. Oh, and also, the date aligns with carbon layer anomalies found in the soil. So, in other words, the sky map on this clay disk wasn't just decorative. It was a data log, a literal screenshot of the night humanity watched the sky try to kill them. So now here's the crazy question. If a group of ancient scribes saw a comet hit the Earth, and they recorded it like scientists, who taught them how to do that? Why did they preserve that specific night? And why was that tablet, along with 30,000 others, buried beneath a palace like a time capsule? Maybe it's because the Sumerians didn't predict an impact, they witnessed one. Alright, so let's talk about something that makes no sense, like zero. Imagine you discover the oldest library in human history, 30,000 tablets. The greatest archaeological jackpot of all time, right? It's basically the Rosetta Stone got married to a UFO black box. So naturally, you start translating, correct? Well, wrong. You'd be wrong. Because here's what actually happened. They found it. They opened it. They translated a tiny piece of it, and then they stopped. So let me say that again for the people in the back of the room. They found a treasure chest full of ancient knowledge and walked away. only 20% has been translated. That's the official number. Roughly 80% of the tablets from Nineveh have never been translated, never studied, never published. In the ones they did translate, most of those were the safe ones. You know, myths, poems, prayers. They barely touched the weird ones. The ones about rituals. The ones about star charts. The ones that read more like technical manuals than bedtime stories. You know, it's like going to a crime scene and only dusting for prints in the lobby. Now, the excuse they give is always the same. These tablets are too damaged, or we don't have the time. But dig just a little more and you'll find receipts. Researchers who've actually worked with the British Museum's archives have noted something extremely strange. Some of the tablets listed as fragmentary or unreadable, they're not. There are internal inventory logs, not public of course, showing that many of these damaged tablets are actually fully intact, or have matching copies in storage. So, if the tablets are readable, and the British Museum has them scanned and labeled, then why won't they release them? Now here's where it gets really shady. The British Museum has spent years digitizing their collection, including the Nineveh tablets. But some of the most interesting ones, the ones with celestial alignments, the ones mentioning, oh, I don't know, the Watchers or Gates, or names that were not to be spoken, these are missing from the public database. We know they were scanned. We know scholars have requested access. And we know those requests are routinely denied. But why? What can possibly be the excuse? Well, here's a few they throw out. Too fragile. Not priority. It's still under review. Same museum that lets you photograph mummies, handle ancient coins, and walk next to dinosaur bones. But a clay tablet from 600 BC? That's where the line gets drawn. Come on. Alright, now let's fast forward to 2003. The US invades Iraq, and in the middle of all the confusion, the Iraq Museum is looted. Over 15,000 priceless artifacts disappear overnight. Many of them, fragments from the Library of Nineveh. Some were smashed, some were taken, and a whole bunch just vanished. Since then, the pieces have been spotted floating through black markets in Dubai, Jordan, and Switzerland. Yes, you heard that right. People are buying ancient cuneiform tablets like they're crypto coins, and they're not showing up in Instagram. These aren't being passed around in archaeology circles. They're disappearing into private collections. Okay, so fair warning. This is where most history channels back out slowly and pretend they forgot something in the car. But not us. So, we're not saying this next part is true. We're not saying it's fiction either. We're just opening the door and letting the weird air in. Because when it comes to the Library of Nineveh, there's a theory that's been whispered, mocked, and loved in equal measure. And it goes like this. What if the tablets weren't just Mesopotamian knowledge? What if they were hand-me-downs from someone else? Enter the Anunnaki. If you've ever spent more than 5 minutes on Ancient Alien, TikTok, or the weirder parts of Reddit, you've heard this name, the Anunnaki. According to mainstream history, the Anunnaki were just the gods of ancient Mesopotamia, sky beings, underworld rulers, the whole mythological gang. But according to Zechariah Sitchin, a fringe author who gained a massive cult following in the 70s and 80s, the Anunnaki weren't gods at all. They were extraterrestrial bioengineers who came from a planet called Nibiru. They allegedly created modern humans by mixing their DNA with early hominids. Now, think ancient astronauts meet Jurassic Park. Now, what's this got to do with Nineveh? Here's where the threads start tangling. Inside the Nineveh tablets, we find stories about divine bloodlines. We see genetic themes in Gilgamesh, like his part god, part human body. There are references to a seed of life being passed down by the gods in the Enuma Elish. And then there's the Sumerian king list. It's a real clay tablet that says some early kings ruled for tens of thousands of years. Like, literally. For example, I quote, King Enmenluana reigned for 43,200 years. Alaugar ruled for 36,000 years. And that's not a misspeak. That's what's written. Now, scholars say those numbers are symbolic. And maybe they are. But even if they admit, they don't really know what they symbolize. In the Epic of Gilgamesh, our main guy isn't fully human. He's described as two-thirds divine. He's supernaturally strong. And he's obsessed with finding a way to live forever. And when he meets Utnapishtim, the guy who survived the Great Flood, he's told there was a time when humans used to be immortal, but the gods took that away. So, that sounds like someone pulled the plug on an earlier operating system. So now you put this together with the idea of an Anunnaki species messing with our genes, and suddenly the story feels less like a bedtime myth, and more like a memory in disguise. So now let's pump the brakes for just a second. Look, Sitchin's work has been shredded by mainstream scholars. They say he mistranslated Sumerian texts, and in fairness, he did some of it. That he cherry-picked phrases to match his theory. And that his Nibiru planet doesn't show up in any real astronomy. And those are all fair criticisms. But here's the thing. Even the experts can't explain why these tablets have thousands of years of cosmic time baked into them. They talk about beings from the sky manipulating the Earth. They can't explain why ancient people were tracking celestial events with the precision of a NASA engineer. So you don't need to believe in aliens to admit one thing. The math is weird. The timelines are even weirder. And the way it was all buried, sealed, and mostly ignored, that's what's weirdest of all. Let's pump the brakes for a second, because we've covered a lot in this episode. And if you're still here, you might be wondering, wait, did this actually happen? Or did I just fall into a four-dimensional history rabbit hole wearing a tinfoil hat? So let's separate what's real, what's fringe, and what's just straight up unknown. No hype, no fear, just facts. Let's start with what's 100% confirmed. First up, the Library of Nineveh. That's absolutely real. It's discovered in 1849 by Austin Henry Layard and Hormuzd Rassam. More than 30,000 tablets were recovered. The tablets themselves, sitting in the British Museum, cataloged, labeled, indexed. You can look them up. You can see pictures. You can read official translations. Now, the Epic of Gilgamesh, it's a real tablet. It's a real story. And yes, it contains a flood narrative that predates Noah by over 1,000 years. Then the Planisphere, tablet K8538. It's a real tablet. Researchers Bond and Hemsel published their findings in 2008, proposing that it described an asteroid event over Austria. Now, do all scientists agree with them? No. But the geology does match, and the tablet's date does line up with known anomalies. Then what about the Sumerian king list? Well, that's also real, on display, and yes, it claims kings ruled for tens of thousands of years. The dream manuals, the omens, the star maps, the ritual guides, they all exist. They've been translated. You can find them in university databases, in peer-reviewed papers, and in museums. So, no theory, no ancient alien guy, just raw historical data etched in stone. Now here's where things get murky. We're not saying these things are fake. We're just saying they haven't been confirmed. Now how about the Anunnaki theory? Well, that's deep in fringe territory. Zechariah Sitchin's translations are widely criticized, and there's no scholarly consensus that aliens visited Mesopotamia. So is it real? We can't say that. It's not our job at Divergent Files to tell you what to believe. We bring the story, the receipts, the patterns, and then let you decide. But what we can say is this. These themes show up across cultures, across eras, and they never seem to go away. Now, how about the suppression? Well, now this part? This is not theory. The silence around Nineveh, the lack of digitization, the refusal to release high-res scans of certain tablets, the artifacts that went missing after the Iraq Museum looting, those are all real, all documented. So you can ignore the aliens. You can dismiss the DNA theories. You can say Gilgamesh is just a myth. But you can't explain why the world's oldest library is still mostly hidden. You can't explain why we digitize everything except this. Because at the end of the day, this isn't about belief. It's not about mythology. It's not even about aliens or conspiracies or secret tombs. It's about access. And right now, we don't have it. We like to think we're the grown-ups in history, that we're the ones who figured it out, built the rockets, split the atom, wrote the books they'll read in the future. But maybe we're just the forgetful ones, the ones who found the message carved in fireproof clay and left it in a basement. We say we want the truth, but only if it fits neatly in our textbooks, only if it doesn't shake the floorboards. The Library of Nineveh didn't die in the fire. It died when we stopped asking what was inside it. What if Ashurbanipal wasn't just archiving the past? What if he was screaming through time? To us? To the generation with satellites and servers, who still can't be bothered to finish reading the warning carved in stone. And maybe the biggest tragedy isn't what we lost in the flames. It's what we still have and pretend we don't see. The oldest knowledge in the world didn't vanish. We just stopped looking at it. The Library of Nineveh didn't burn quietly, and neither should the truth. Because the people who sealed those tablets in clay weren't just trying to save their stories. They were trying to save ours. So if this episode made you think twice about what we keep, what we bury, and what we're still not allowed to see, then help us keep digging. So until next time, stay curious, stay grounded, and remember, no matter what they tell you, the truth is still out there.